ओम नमो भागवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भागवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भागवते वासुदेवाय नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नारं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जयामुदीरयेत् नास्तिप्रायेष्वभद्रेषु नित्यं भागवतसेवया भागवती उत्तमा श्लोके Bhakti Bhavati Naistiki. It's chanted Nastaprayeshwabhadreshu. This is the invocation for our class. It's in the first canto, first chapter. And it means that by regular attendance in the class of Bhagavatam, all that is inauspicious to the heart becomes completely destroyed. And loving service to the Lord becomes established as an irrevocable fact. Cannot be changed. So that's why the Bhagavatam is, this class is one of the most important parts of our day. It is something that Srila Prabhupada emphasized, and at the same time, to study Bhagavatam is very challenging because it has between 14 and 18,000 verses, depending on how you divide it up. So Srila Prabhupada set out to translate Srimad Bhagavatam to English as his great life's work. This was after years of publishing Back to Godhead on his own and publishing some small books. Then he undertook this Srimad Bhagavatam at age roughly, 60 or so, 58. So try to envision Srila Prabhupada living alone in Vrindavan with practically no money whatsoever. And whatever he did himself. He did all his own cooking, cleaning, laundry, and he did his own publishing, he did his own trips to the printer, and he took the books or the magazines and went out and distributed them himself. And in this way, as an older man, he was undertaking this task. He figured it would take, if he lived to be 90 or so, at that time he was estimating he might finish Srimad Bhagavatam. So absolutely no fear about this undertaking. So this is another quality of the devotee, akatobayam, fearless. So Prabhupada describes there are three types of people. There are those who are ichitam. Anyone know what it means to be ichitam? Itchy? You have to have a lot of material desire. So ichitam, and then nirvidyamananam. After having a lot of material desires and trying to fulfill them, then what happens? You're frustrated. Nirvidyamananam. Now I don't want anything to do with it. So these are the two extremes, you see. Those who are really after material enjoyment and those who say, no, I'm totally giving up all material enjoyment. I don't want anything to do with it. Ichitam, nirvidyamananam. And then akuto, those who are fearless. So that is the position of the devotee. And all kinds of people can benefit from Srimad Bhagavatam. It doesn't matter where we are in the beginning of our study. So with that introduction, I just wanted to share with you, these are copies of Prabhupada's original Bhagavatams. We have no way of knowing whether he ever handled them or not, but you can imagine that he did. And I just wanted to pass around the volume if everyone would just like to take a look. You look at it. This is what Srila Prabhupada struggled. Thank you, Prabhupada. Struggled so hard to produce. And brought with him to America is practically his only luggage. So the Bhagavatam is that text which, more than any other, takes one to the higher qualities of Vaishnavism. Bhagavad Gita is the ABC, the basics. We have to know. We're not this body. Serving God is the dharma of every living entity. It's basic tenets of Vaishnavism. But Bhagavatam takes us to a whole different level. And it is a lifelong study. Srila Prabhupada's Guru Maharaj, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta, spent 3 months once in Dhaka, Bangladesh, lecturing on this verse. Every morning for 3 months. on one verse. And he said that any verse of Bhagavatam you could lecture on for 3 months. So in the West, we're going to do all 18,000 of them in about 130 classes. So I wanted to give a little orientation this morning on how we're going to approach that. And because it is, this is experimental, and the goal is to see, is to allow anyone who enters the Krishna House, the GIMS program, Gainful Institute for Vaishnava Study, can leave it with a comprehensive overview of Bhagavatam. This is not going to substitute for a thorough verse-by-verse, canto-by-canto study, but it will give you an ability to grasp the whole picture of Srimad Bhagavatam, and that's very helpful. Some of us who lived in temples in the 70s, might have taken 10 or 15 years to achieve a real kind of overview, because you hear a little bit here, a little bit there, verse by verse. It takes a long, long time. So we're going to not going to abandon the format of having an intensive study every day of one sloka. We're going to do that, but we're picking out 108 of the most prominent slokas from Srimad Bhagavatam to study in detail with our daily class. The only difference is that the sections between the verses, our speakers will bring the reader, the students, up to date. What has happened since the verse we read yesterday that brings us to this verse? Okay. So, in that regard, we have two textbooks to help us, which are going to be part of our course. A book called Srimad Bhagavatam at a Glance by Narayani Devi Dasi. Narayani Prabhu is a senior disciple of Srila Prabhupada who has lived in Vrindavan for, I don't know, more than 20 years. And she teaches the Bhakti Vaibhav course for devotees from all over the world who want to go in depth in Srimad Bhagavatam. This is a guide which is very helpful for our purposes. So when you get your copy, kindly pull out the big, there's a big drawing inside. I'd like everyone to open that up and we'll get an initial overview of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's this one. Right. So just elbow your neighbor and spread out in front of you as best you can so you can take a look at how these 12 cantos fit together to form the body of Krishna. Not quite yet. Okay, just hang on to the blue book for a moment and we're going to focus on this drawing. Alright, so the Srimad Bhagavatam in 12 cantos is compared to the body of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So if you see canto 1, let's let everyone look at canto 1 down at the bottom. See that divided into 5 sections. Narada and Vyas, Krishna in Hastinapur and Dwarka, Parikshit born, excuse me, 4 sections, and Parikshit in his pastime. Each of the 12 cantos is so divided. By Narayana Prabhu. Very nicely done. That will form a basis for our overview. We're going to take 2 verses from each petal of each lotus and study those two of the very prominent verses and pivotal verses in those sections. So we'll be able to take time to understand each pastime and take a couple of verses out of context, or in context with that pastime, deal with a particular theme and particular episode or junction of the event. Okay? That's the basic format for our 108 great verses. In addition, we'll have a review of each canto. After completing the petals on the lotus of each canto, we'll take one day and just review them all, fill in any gaps, answer any questions. Okay? Before we go on, questions is a point I wanted to make, I wanted to emphasize here. In Bhagavad Gita chapter 4, verse 34, Krishna says that there are 2 things required of the spiritual aspirant when approaching a spiritual master. And what are those 2 things? Yes. Pari Krishnena and Sevaya. So Sevaya means, okay, of the 2, which do you think is easier? Yeah. Service is easier because every living entity has a natural serving propensity. So as soon as we get it, the light goes on, oh, okay, I'll serve Krishna. Then that's pretty easy to connect. The harder of the two is Hare Krishna. More difficult, more demanding, actually, to ask good questions, relevant questions. There is only one dumb question. And what is that? What? It's the one you didn't ask. That was dumb. Any other question is fine. And on a personal level, since our purpose here is really developing our heart and our realization, any question that crosses your mind is fair game to ask. Okay? There is no question that's off limits except why I was late for Mangal Arati. Okay? Any other question? Now, any question, seriously, because it's the material world, we have envious tendencies, and we can look at somebody and think, why are they doing this? Okay? And then we may try to shut down that question. No, I don't want to ask that, it's offensive. But this is actually not helpful. It's better to ask that question. It may not be appropriate to ask in Bhagavatam class. I'd like to know why such and such hasn't done this yet, or is so messy. I'd like to know why this person is so messy. You know, this is not a public question, but it is a question that is appropriate to address. Because if we don't get these things out, then they just fester. In other words, we don't want to go through the motions of being a Vaishnava. If we want to be Vaishnavas, we need to be straightforward in our dealings. Okay? And the art of asking the right question is knowing whom to ask and how to ask. So there is a way to ask questions that are touchy, and it is a way that is explained in the Bible, actually. When you criticize not the sinner, yes. So it's understood that all of us are going to make mistakes. We don't criticize the person who makes the mistake, we criticize or question the apparent mistake. I've had so many experiences in my career as a devotee, where I had assumed somebody was doing something wrong and felt myself a little better than they, or felt them to be a little, you know, ridiculous. And when I actually found out about it, I completely misunderstood their motive and completely understood their perspective. So it's important to be able to ask a question, what is going on? If you ask about the behavior and not the person, then you're able to ask a question without offending. So, this is a deep subject, I just wanted to touch on it, and encourage you to ask questions. If you sense hypocrisy, or some difference in the philosophy that we're reading and the way that we're living, ask about it. No question is off limits for this class discussion, okay? In fact, the more controversial the question, the better the class. The more likely everyone is to stay awake. Okay, so there is no question off limits for discussion in our classes. Any questions about that? Yes, Cindy. Yes, but that's an art, and it's better to ask a question in the wrong way and learn from it, than to not ask the question for being afraid I'll offend somebody. Okay? So ask the questions, please, you know, that really are relevant. This is the meaning of Hare Krishna. Things that are actually in your mind and heart. Please. That's what our class is for. Because there'll be a time every day for asking those questions. Alright? Now, back to our overview here, huh? So the first canto and the second canto are Krishna's what? His lotus feet. So, you cannot stand without the use of your feet. The whole text rests on canto 1 and 2. That's why for the past 2 years here at the Krishna House, we've spent the entire both semesters studying the first canto. And the last few summers, we've done the second canto. So in this semester, we're going to cover the first and second canto, just to give you an example, in about 16 classes. 16 days. So, they're compared to Krishna's feet is that they deal with the subject of, first of all, the whole background of Srimad Bhagavatam, so that you know who is speaking and why, and the process of creation, Lord Brahma, how the universe is created. So, cantos 1 and 2 deal with the Bhagavatam and then with the creation of the universe. Now, cantos 3 and 4 are compared to Krishna's what? Yeah, his legs, in general, his legs, okay? So these are the legs. The legs take you places. So canto 3 deals with the misuse of the material energy for the first time. So in canto 2, the material energy is created, or the material universe is created. Then canto 3, who comes in and abuses it? Yeah, Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu. Although Hiranyakashipu comes a little bit later in detail. So we learn about how immediately the conditioned souls start misusing the material energy. And after this episode of it, the material energy being misused, then who comes and explains and later in the third canto the appropriate way to use the material energy? Kapila, correct. The last 8 chapters of the third canto deal in depth with what's called Samkhya, or the philosophy of using the material energy in the process of creation. So then canto 4, having explained how material nature is abused in canto 3, then canto 4 goes into pastimes that show the proper use, dharma, of material energy. Who are some of the leading figures there in the fourth canto? Prithvi Maharaj, Dhruva Maharaj, right? And also the King Chitraketu, who has a very adventurous life. Okay, so those are from the, I'm sorry, that's the fourth, that's sixth canto. Not Chitraketu, Paranja. And Puccini Barisha, the king who's a little materialistic, who hears from Narada Muni, a long allegory. That's the fourth canto. So again, third canto, how the energy is misused. Fourth canto, how it's used properly. Fifth canto takes us to Krishna's what? Yeah, his navel. Okay, so the navel is this the central point where the legs come together, where there is it's actually the genesis of the body. You know, our nutrients initially come from the umbilical cord there, navel. So the fifth canto is highlighted by the discussion of a great king using the ruling the material world, but becoming enlightened in spiritual life through some difficult events. Who is that great king? Bharat Maharaj. Right. It also deals with the kind of the backside of Krishna's body, which is what? The fifth canto. What are the hellish planets. So they're compared to Krishna's backside, right? People think that God is just all good and the devil's responsible for all evil. But Prabhupada said, no, the evil is coming from Krishna's backside. So that's also Krishna's energy. So there we find in the fifth canto, the midsection. Then we go to canto 6, which is canto 5 consolidates. It shows how the material energy can be used and lead to enlightenment through the story of Maharaj Bharata. There's very potent instructions from his father and then his life and application of those teachings. Canto 4 is, the Dharma is a little bit more, I don't want to say mundane, but a little bit more formulaic. Like Dhruva Maharaj, for example, wants a big kingdom. Right? And Prithvi Maharaj exemplifies the ruling, proper ruling spirit. And they both also have transcendental qualities, but fifth canto has Maharaj Bharata pastime is fully transcendental. Alright? Sixth canto is Krishna's what? And what important organ does the chest contain? What? The heart. Yeah. Okay. So what is the heart of Srimad Bhagavatam? What do you think the heart is? What pastime from the sixth canto? Pardon? No, that's seventh canto. What? Ajamiya, yes. Why would that be the heart, Ajamiya? Potency of the holy name, yes. And Jamiel is this very sinful person who is delivered by the holy name. That's the heart of the Bhagavatam in the sixth canto. And the seventh and eighth canto are Krishna's, right, what do you do with your arms? Actions like what? Protection, yes, fighting, and you, what do you do? Yes, you give, and you also, yeah. So seventh and eighth cantos are full of stories of the demons and the devotees, the demigods battling. And so they're one is taking and the other is taking back and giving up and, you know, back and forth. Like Prahlad Maharaj and Hiranyakashipu, you know, Hiranyakashipu conquers the universe and then Lord Nrisimhadev takes it back. And then the Mohini Murti, the demons conquer the universe again, and then the devotees take it back with the help of Mohini. So there's all this struggle going on, back and forth, give and take, seventh and eighth canto. Then the ninth canto is Krishna's neck, his neck. So what is the business of the neck? Everything below that just kind of comes together in this one little narrow channel. Okay? So that it brings everything to a focus. And this is the content of the ninth canto. The ninth canto is largely a description of the Surya Vamsa, which is the dynasty of, Vamsa means family or dynasty, and that's the dynasty of who? Surya. Means, Surya is what? The sun. Yeah, the sun dynasty. And Lord Rama is the exemplar of that dynasty. And finally, the description of the Chandravamsa, or the moon dynasty. And of course, that dynasty is the one in which whom appears? Lord Krishna. Right, so it brings us up to the family lineage of Lord Krishna. That is the end of the ninth canto. And we need to cover this information before being eligible to go to the tenth canto. This tenth canto then is Krishna's what? Smiling face. Right, and there we are, the entire 10th canto, every bit of it, is spoken by Shukadev Goswami, or those he is quoting directly, in describing the episodes of Krishna's life. It is the longest canto. It comprises 90 chapters, about one-fifth of the entire text. So, yeah, in fact, more than that. The whole Bhagavatam is 335 chapters. So we have 90 of those chapters, more than a quarter in the text. It's the main part of the text. But, although that is the part everyone likes to read and talk about, even the scholars, the acharyas say very emphatically, you need to go through the first nine in order to appreciate it. Not only to know the background, because the 10th canto is full of references to the earlier cantos. But if we fail to understand philosophically, you know, what's going on in the Bhagavatam, then we are left with only what? What is religion without philosophy? Right, it's sentiment or fanaticism. And there's definitely fanaticism amongst devotees. And there's definitely sentiment amongst devotees. And sentiment or fanaticism for the right thing are okay. It's just not complete. You know, with philosophy, then we can actually have full spiritual realization. On the other hand, just to have philosophy without religion is, yeah, just mental speculation. And even at the University of Florida, with all due respect to our good friend Krishna Sharan Prabhu, Krishna Sharan Prabhu is not able to attend today because he is preparing to teach class. He's like our Trojan horse in the academic world. You know this Trojan horse? Yeah, they're our secret agent. So he's teaching the very dry topics of philosophy from the point of view of knowing the conclusion, which is what actually what Srila Prabhupada wanted. He said devotees should be teaching these courses, and he is a wonderful example of that. So Krishna's smiling face is appreciated by those who have both philosophy and spirituality. Yeah. Yeah. it's like, have you ever been shopping somewhere and the person in front of you can't make up their yeah, it's very hard to make a decision when we're on the mental platform. This is speculation. That's what the meaning is. In other words, we want to talk about spiritual life, or we want to talk about God, but we don't want to commit to anything. So that's what it means to be, you know, speculation mode. Just maybe this, or maybe that. And the idea of a speculator is that eventually when I find out what I want, then I'll commit to it. And in the course of that activity, there is no commitment at all. So this is why it's dry. And people can spend their whole lives just discussing ideas and concepts and never doing anything. Right? When I was in the library party, the book distribution party, we had there was a professor, a famous professor, who was the most noted scholar of Chaitanya in America and in the world, at least the Western world, Edwin Dimmick. So Edwin Dimmick in the University of Chicago and his compadres would sit around and read Chaitanya Charitamrita and drink wine. This is their pastime. They would enjoy their academic, penetration of this mythological text. And it was sort of a pleasure for them. So speculation is just empty. That's why Bhagavatam is called the Amala Purana, the spotless Purana, because it brings not only the philosophy, but the life, the juice, the pastimes. And the pastimes are primarily in the 10th canto. And but without the philosophical basis, we can't appreciate it. Okay? 10th? The 11th canto? Krishna is what? Right. And what is the quality of the forehead? Pardon me? Beautifies the face. Yes. It also protects the what? What's behind the forehead, at least in some cases. Yes, the brain. That is the intellectual part of the Bhagavatam. So what is the portion of the 11th canto that's specifically known for that quality? Uddhava Gita. Yes, the Uddhava Gita. This is when Krishna is just about to leave this world. He sits and speaks with Uddhava for 28 chapters. It's comparable, very comparable to the Bhagavad Gita. It's very, very beautiful. If you study the Gita, then reading Uddhava Gita is really a treat. It's the same philosophy, but presented in different ways and beautiful analogies. So that's the gorgeous part of it, the Bhagavatam. Unfortunately, we won't really be able to go in as deeply as I'd like to. And finally, the 12th canto is what? Yes. I'm sorry, what is it? Like the brain. The brain is there behind the forehead. Because it's Krishna's emphatic philosophical discussion just before leaving this world. It's like going on a trip and somebody's going to take care of your house. Before you go, you say, okay, be sure to water this and give all detailed instructions. Okay? So Uddhava Gita is something like that. Uddhava asks very nice questions and Krishna explains at every point from, again, like a reminder of the basic philosophy that's there at the conclusion. It's a philosophical and very analytical presentation for living life Krishna consciously that Krishna gives just before leaving this world. So that's why it's compared to the forehead, beautifying the face or protecting the brain. Yes, but when Krishna gets it, then it's better than even better. So, finally, the 12th canto is compared to Krishna's what? The crown, top of his head. The crown is called Brahma Rundram. You know that when a baby is born, they've got a little soft spot on top of their head. Did you know that? Yeah, some of them are still soft. It's supposed to, the bones are supposed to knit and become a solid there. But there is a gap, and the yogis can actually lift their soul out and go through the top of their head when they leave this body. The usually people meet through their anus or genital. And in great fear, that's why they pass through stool and urine at the time of death. Because they're very terrified of what's happening. But the yogi, self-controlled yogi, can actually go through this. So it's the crown, it's the conclusion, it's in French, the denouement, the culmination of the text. So the 12th canto deals with what? Anyone remember? Yes, it deals with Kali Yuga, primarily. It's a fairly short canto, and it talks about prophecy. Like the Bible, you have the last book is what? Revelation. So this is what's going to happen. So the 12th canto is like that. Gives a description of what's going to happen in Kali Yuga, and the things, everything is just right on. It's amazing. So that is the way that the 12 cantos comprise Krishna's body. Any questions on this? How do we understand other philosophies? It depends on the individual case. The best way to deal with that question is to ask people what is their philosophy, and then try to deal, not again, not hate the sin, but the sinner, but the sin. So if they've got some kind of philosophy, try to understand what is it that they're advocating? And just asking people that question will very often get you to a point where you can deal with it without offending them. So I'm answering your question in a broad way. What if people say, well, where does Buddhism fit in Srimad Bhagavatam? Well, actually, Buddha is mentioned in Bhagavatam. And in fact, he's mentioned in the 12th canto in the prediction. See, in the very village where he was born, he's mentioned. Which is amazing, you know. That's why some scholars say, oh, the Bhagavatam could not be older than Buddhism, because Buddha's predicted there. Therefore, somebody wrote it afterwards. They're cheating. It can't be 5,000 years old, because Buddha was 2,500 years old. That we have to ask Kriyananda Maharaj. I believe that does exist. The original text of Bhagavatam. I know we don't have the Mahabharata, but I believe we do the Bhagavatam. All right, so, yes, right on. Yes. Two dealt with creation of material energy. Three deals with misuse of that energy. Four deals with proper use of that energy. In very simple terms. In this way, not a scriptural reference. These come from the Acharyas and from scholars. That's a good question. I don't know the background. That would be a good question if we can get Narayana Prabhu to come over and visit us. We could ask him. But we'll spend at least a couple of minutes of every class at the beginning reciting the verses of the monk. That's what we're going to ask the speakers to do. Just going over them. By rote. See? No discussion, no practice, just everyone reading the synonyms, reading the Sanskrit and the Sanskrit. What do you say if somebody says, I already love God, what do you say? There's a really nice morning walk through Prabhupada at Denver. He was arguing this very point. He was saying to the devotees, well, I already love God, why are you laying your stuff on me? I love God. And they were trying to feed him this way and that way, and Prabhupada would say, well, that is what you say. I love God. You cannot tell me I love God. I don't love God. And he was just feeding him over and over and over again. And finally, somebody said one thing that... Does anyone remember that? Quote. The devotee asked him, if you love God, why don't you obey him? Yes, that is the point. And, you know, obey is connected with that Sevaya, you know. That's the easy part. It's actually easier to obey. It's a preliminary part, isn't it? The preliminary part is, okay, I accept that God exists and I will obey Him. And there's so many things to understand about God and about our own faults and our own... Because when we see, when we learn something about God, our own faults become very clear. And this is what Prabhupada says at that point. It's the most basic thing to obey. So if somebody asks you, they say, I love God, how would you respond to that? Don't tell me, I don't love God. Who is this person you love? Suppose you went to a party with your wife, and then you're talking with somebody, and said, I came with my wife, she's the love of my life. Oh, well, which one is she? The blonde or the brunette? I don't know. Is she the tall one or the short one? Me. But I really love her. So how much love can there be if we don't know who is the object of our love? This is the real weakness in Judeo-Christian modern theology, isn't it? And they think that there is no need to answer this question. There's no need for God is love. You get this saccharine, you know, gooey kind of stuff. God is one. God is love. Love is God. One is love. If you really press people on the point, they cannot answer. That's why we are.
I find that that most of the Christians do think they know who God is, and they would say He's Jesus Christ, my Savior. But that's the question that we get most of the time. At that point, I really don't really get into debate with them if he's Jesus, you know, if Jesus is God or not, because like even now scriptures, you know, Krishna came as a devotee, you know, he came as Mahaprabhu, okay? So even if he did come as, you know, Christ, you know, that's not his original form, you know, he came as the Son, he didn't come as himself, so I don't really debate with him on that so much, because... You know, it's kind of like,
okay. That's a practical answer. And generally people don't want to, it's not a good idea to get in an intense debate if somebody's very fanatical on their point. But, Mark, do you have comments?
Basically the representative of God. But then that's great. I argue that his representative of God, Jesus Christ, the spiritual master. So if you follow his directions precisely, which most preachers do not, then you can attain liberation of this form of God, but you have to follow exactly what the Bible says and exactly what he has said. But I think that Jesus is not God and our incarnation of God. So you can't argue.
Philosophically, people say that Jesus is God. The position actually is very weak, very Christian. You simply ask them, where does Jesus say I am God? And they give you one quote, and they say, I and the Father are one. So then they're able to understand. You can explain, well, there's oneness in purpose. It's like if you have a great relationship with your Father, you're on the same page, you have the same goal and the same desire. But it doesn't mean you become your Father. If Jesus is God, why does he keep talking about his Father as the one who sent him? A whole other thing. Yeah, God and the Son, the Father and the Spirit and the Holy Ghost are all one. It's like three manifestations of God, which is fine. I mean, we also have that, but there's still the person originating all of it.
Yes, it's been my experience preaching to Christians that some Christians believe that there is difference. There's Christ and then there's God. And some Christians believe that it's just, Christ is God, you know. So it's been helpful in terms of how I preach to them. I'll say, like, all the time, what about the Father? You know, Christ talks about the Father.